All right, everyone, let's get started. This is, of course, the work in progress session for FAST 2012. This is very exciting. I, of course, am your host, James W. Mickens, and this is me right there. I'm pretty spectacular. I get a lot of requests, about 20 to 57 every day, to come in and provide my wisdom to different crowds. So I think I can safely say that you've been blessed by my presence today, and you're welcome for that. There are rules, just like in real life here in the work in progress session. Luckily for everyone here, the rules are simple. Rule number one is that I am the boss. Rule number two is see rule number one. Okay, we're going to keep a tight ship here. Okay, that's extremely important. Why is that important? Well, the WIP session is kind of like my dojo. Okay, it's kind of like my studio space. All right, I come here, it's a happy place for me. Okay, so we're going to stay on time, under budget. Now, if we don't do that, then that makes me angry. Why is that a problem for you? Well, that's a problem because I am a level 7 human weapon. This has been certified, of course, by the Mossad. This is serious, okay? As you can tell from this picture, I spend a lot of time attacking irregularly shaped wooden objects so that if you attack me in the style of an irregularly shaped wooden object, I will know exactly what to do. Now, moving on. Am I the Kwisatz Haderach? Maybe. Don't test me, okay? We want to have a fun time here, though, so let's keep it light, let's keep it easy. As I said before, there are rules. Basically, each person gets 5 minutes to talk, and then there is 1 minute for questions. We're going to stay on schedule. If you take more time than you've been allotted, then I'm going to judge you in the style of Samuel L. Jackson. This will be serious, okay? I don't goof around here. Why do I feel so confident in saying things about your loved ones that I may regret later? Let me answer that question. This is my Facebook profile. There's something to notice here. It's not the rose, okay? I am quite smooth, but that's not the point. The point is that thing down there at the bottom, okay? I have 500 friends. I don't need you as a friend, okay? I have a lot of people who like me already, okay? So you get up here, you go over your allotted time, I start yelling things at you, wham, 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 I get aboard the Wambulance, okay? I don't care, all right? All that being said, though, guys, let's have a great time, okay? Stay positive. You know, this is an uplifting experience. Just don't make mistakes. That's the key thing. Don't make mistakes. And so here is the lineup for all of the presenters. They should have seen this already, but take a moment to look at this and make sure you understand where you are in the program. All right, let's get started. Vasily, I believe you are up first.
I'll try to follow the rules. I'm really scared. All right, my name is Vasily Tarasov. I'm from Stony Brook University, and I'm going to talk about our approach for generating realistic datasets for data application analysis. This work is done in collaboration with Amar Mandrakid and Eric Zadek from Stony Brook University, Will Buick and Jeff Koenig from Harvey Mudd, and Philip Shalane from EMC. So let me quickly remind you how data application works. For example, we have a 1 terabyte piece of data, you somehow manage to identify duplicates within it. Then you can store just a single instance of these duplicates and maintain a logical to physical mapping. This way you save your storage, for example, in this specific example, 20% of it. Though the general idea of deduplication is very simple, there are many approaches how it can be implemented. You can use different chunking algorithms, different hashing functions, a bunch of optimizations can be applied during the indexing. So as a result, we have a lot of papers and a lot of products that implement deduplication differently. And all of them, of course, claim that they're the best. But we need to think and understand that evaluation of any deduplication solution depends on the data set that was used during the evaluation. So we looked at the data sets that were used in recently published papers, and we looked at 120 of them. And it turned out that 53% of them are private, so they're not released because of privacy issues. 14% are public, but very hard to reproduce. For example, these are daily snapshots of CNN.com from 2004. Then 17% of the data sets are less than 1 gigabyte, so that's really not enough to stress any real deduplication system. 9% are very simplistic, they were generated, but in a very simplistic manner. And 7% are virtual machine images that are large enough, but this is really a small coverage. So we believe that there is a need for data sets that will allow us to perform fair evaluation of different deduplication solutions so that we can compare them. These data sets need to be accessible, realistic, sufficiently large, easily to distribute, and preferably controllable so that we can change them a little bit in some controlled manner. And we think we can generate them. So our main insight is that the data sets that are usually used to evaluate the duplication are formed in two ways or in combination of these two ways. So in the first way, you have initial original file system that changes over time, and every snapshot is put in the data set. So it's a typical backup scenario. The second way is then the initial file system is given to multiple users, and this file system originally is the same, but then users run their set of applications and perform their tasks. So as a result, these file systems start to diverge. And again, maybe all of these users share the same remote storage. So, and this forms a data set. So the main operation here is file system change, or how we call it file system mutation. If we can emulate it accurately, we'll be able to generate data sets accurately. So how do we do that in several bullets? First of all, we observe how real file system change. Then we collect a bunch of statistics about these changes. Right now, for example, we use Markov model to identify which files to delete, to create, or to modify. And we use multidimensional distributions to store information about how the files should be modified, should they be extended, or anything else should be done. And finally, using these statistics, we are generating data sets that resemble the real one. So our poster was yesterday, but we'll have another today. So if you have any questions, don't be shy, come by and ask questions. And you also can ask questions right now. Thanks. Okay, I was clear, thanks.
Excellent. Next person, get up, we're all behind, go.
Hi, I'm Yati from the University of Utah. I know you'll be really excited about this. So today we make it easy for you to induce disk failures. Yes, so why do I want to make your disks fail, right? So today's storage stacks of modern cloud systems are really complex, and you need an experimentation environment to reason about how your systems behave in the face of disk failures. So that's the key motivation behind this work. And so, As I mentioned, modern cloud systems have really complex storage stacks, and to induce and test various disk failures on such a massive scale becomes really challenging, and hence it would be nice to have a framework for you to inject disk errors and experiment and see how your systems behave in the face of disk failures. So that's one of the key goals behind, key motivations behind this work. And so at such a massive scale, it's really hard for you to get control your disk conditions in a way that is transparent to existing systems, realistic, and allows easy experimentation. So that's some of the goals behind building such a framework. And it would also be nice to script these conditions ahead of time or dynamically change them at your will. So what you really want to do is coordinate these failures and be able to get a repeated failure across your experiments. So that's some of the goals behind our framework. And so we are making this framework on top of, we are building this framework on top of Emulab, which is a networking testbed. And this is the overview of our design. So we are leveraging Device Mapper, which is available on Linux, and it provides us with a bunch of useful disk models, useful for emulating disk failures. And some of the things you can do with it are you can delay IOs to emulate slow disk behavior, you can corrupt reads or writes, or you can even induce sector errors. And you can choose one of these error models and feed it off to the MLab event system. And we have a piece of software which we call Disk Agent, which basically listens to such events and it triggers the specified disk conditions at your will. And we can do this on the entire testbed, so you can choose some 100 different nodes, and you can tell that I want to fail a bunch of hard disks on this particular node at this particular time. So you get a kind of repeated and controlled behavior across your experiments. And so here's an example of the delay model in action. So here is a graph depicting a disk which starts off being normal, and after 22 seconds, I've invoked the delay model and I've delayed all the IOs by 100 milliseconds, and the throughput you see just drops. And then 72 seconds later, I've restored the disk back to being normal and the throughput just resumes back. And some of the things we are yet to do is, right now, Device Mapper just provides a very simplistic disk models, and hence we would like to extend this to capture more realistic disk failure models. And I'm looking for more suggestions from the crowd. Come talk to me. And some of the things we are considering of doing is replaying disk IO traces. And so that's one thing that we considered. And the prototype will be available soon on Emulab. And please feel free to talk to me after this session and give me your ideas. Thanks. Any questions, answers?
Any questions? You're a very efficient audience, okay? Excellent.
Thanks.
Question.
Okay.
Namarfi from Google. Are you sending your patches to the open source Linux kernel?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Are you sending your patches to the open source Linux kernel?
We have not patched anything in Device Mapper as of now. We are just making use of it.
Okay.
So it's cool. Just deploying it on MLab. Yeah. Thanks.
Excellent. I like your confidence getting up there.
Hello everyone, I'm happy to be here to introduce our work. My name is Jae-ho Kim, I'm a PhD student at the University of Seoul in Korea. The title of this talk is DS-RAID, Efficient Parity Update Scheme for SSD. This is joint work with the members of the university. Okay, let me start it. One serious problem of current SSD is it's a low reliability, since it's a primary component. Flash memory has a higher weight, limited range count. Furthermore, multi-level cell flash memory aggravates the problems. One solution is to provide RAID 5 configuration with chips comprising the SSD device. Here is an example of disk-based RAID 5. RAID 5 constructs a data set called the strip. We assume that some data already written to the system. And if A1 and A2 are updated, A3 must be read for parity calculation. This is generally called small write problem. As you can see in the figure, a strip is constructed based on logical block number of data. And we call it as a LBN striping hereafter. LBN striping is originally designed for HDD. With its overwrite property. When adapting RAID 5 configuration to flash memory, there are some editor burden. Because flash memory cannot write updates, the detailable burden will be explained later with some example. Since flash memory uses out-of-place update scheme, LBN-based striping is not suitable for flash memory. To solve the problem, we propose dynamic striping RAID, called DS-RAID. Here is a detail of DS-RAID. As you can see in the figure, the stripe consists of D0, D1, D3, D8, and parity 0. That is a not consecutive logical blank number. Instead of LBM based striping, this way the dynamically constructed a stripe based on arrival order of a write request, which we call physical page number, PPM based striping. This figure shows the difference between RAID 5 and DS RAID. Also, we assume that D1, D2, D3, and D4 are updated. In case of RAID 5, updated data must be written to the same chip of all the data, and it requires additional read, calculation, and writing of two parities. But why? In case of DS RAID, data simply written to chip 0 to chip 3 according to arrival order of them with a single parity. To process the update, RAID 5 and DS RAID require such IO operations. This shows the benefit of RAID DS RAID in terms of performance and cleaning cost. As you can see in the figure, With the DS RAID, data are written to evenly. However, RAID 5, data of RAID 5 are written to chip 3 more, such as skewed write, leading to reduced lifetime of flash memory. Now we consider the case when only part of the stripe written. For example, data D8 and D9 are being newly written with the DS RAID. Parity can be calculated even for incomplete stripe. However, RAID 5 went until before parity is calculated. So if a failure occurred, RAID 5 may lose incomplete stripe due to without parity. For evaluation, we use the disk CM, postmark, and random write workload. Result shows the higher performance and write count of DS RAID relative to that of RAID 5. We see that response time is reduced to roughly half for random write. And XLR write are reduced 60% for random write. Thank you. Thank you.
Can you start the file?
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, hello everyone. We have come to depend on a continuing and dramatic growth in magnetic disk storage density. This growth cannot continue without creative techniques to magnetic recording, and one of the most promising of the techniques is single magnetic recording. Single magnetic recording requires us to reconsider how we optimize reads and write on the write. The reason for this is single magnetic recording employs overlapping data track, which results in a narrow track on the disk. Unfortunately, this means we cannot overwrite a track without affecting the adjacent tracks in the band. To avoid the need to update a completely disk to accommodate the update of previous written track and to effectively localize the update to smaller discrete portion of the disk, a single write disk is arranged into a distinct bands. And today, we, from Santa Clara University, we will evaluate the behavior of a single write disk when used in a array configuration when faced with the heavy interleaved workload from multiple sources. Our initial finding, heavily interleaved workload can have a dramatic negative impact on the disk activity. Reducing interleaving has a significant positive effect. And this figure shows the logical view of a simple array of disks. In a stripe arrangement, block 0, 1, 2, 3 will arrive as A1, B1, C1, and D1. And in a spanning or a bureau configuration, the block 0, 1, 2, 3 will become at A1, A2, A3, and A4. And our model uses the workload space evaluation. Here we consider three different kinds of workloads. The first is striped workload. The second is bureau workload. And the third is dedicated workload. This has different characteristics. The first one, using a composite of four workloads. And it makes vary by adjusting a random interleave. The second one is arranged in the sequence and time varying workloads, but not interleaving. The dedicated workload is very simple. It dedicates the disk to individual workload sources. And unlike bureau and stripe workloads, no interleaving per disk. And the measurement is total track switches across four disks. And this figure shows this activity when replaying multiple source traces against a simulated array of single write disks. And this graph is based on a log scale. The x-axis represents the number of the bus size increasing from a minimum of one up to a bus size of 1,000 operations. And the y-axis represents a total number of track switches. And for the bus size number one, we can see the big difference between the striped and the dedicated workloads. It's about 18 times difference. But when the bus size comes to 50, the difference will close by four. And it quickly approaches the number of operations by the bureau workload. And the display option here is dedicated disk and bank and the workload differentiation. Thank you. And do you have any questions? Thank you. And thank you, everyone. And if you're interested in the topic, and please come and see me at the poster session. Thank you again.
What's that?
Presenters, don't close the WIP folder because then we have to spend time trying to open it again, and then I will judge you in the hallway section.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Andy Hospidor. I'm from the University of California at Santa Cruz, and I'm joined here by Ethan. Even better. Thank you so much. So I'm still Andy Hospidor, and I'm still with the University of California at Santa Cruz. I'm joined here with Ethan Miller, Rekha Pikmuchani, and Yangwook Kang, also from Santa Cruz, Ahmed Amer from Santa Clara University, and Yulai Zai, who worked on this with us from China. And so I hope to answer some questions in this space regarding unified object-oriented storage architecture. But first, I'm going to start with, I'll be starting with, hasn't this been done already? To begin, I want to start with the definition of virtualization, because I think that'll help us a little bit in what we're talking about here. My definition of virtualization is the ability to take a brand new, just designed storage device and make it appear like a 1986 SCSI disk drive so it doesn't break the file system and device driver stack. We pretty much spend all of our effort trying to do that. We've been doing it now for about 40 years, and it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to continue doing it. It served us well throughout the 90s and even into the 2000s because storage devices became commoditized as they adopted standardized interfaces, and SCSI was an important one for sure. But the object-oriented disk drives were even proposed as extensions to standard interfaces to SCSI way back, you know, even into the late 90s. The problem was that they were limited to a specific class of storage device, such as active disk, and a specific interface, such as SCSI. And the real problem now is that new devices often require additional commands. For example, flash memory requires a trim command to function correctly. And if anybody is familiar with the implementations of trim, it's really hard to find one that's consistent across operating systems and devices. It just doesn't work well for us. So what I'm going to propose is that we look at first decoupling the metadata from the data, and we consider storage devices that will manage objects instead of blocks. So this is going to be a little bit of blasphemy for people here, file systems people. It's okay, you know, just relax. We'll get through it. But what we're talking about is moving the low-level storage management out of the file system and onto the storage device. The storage device has the most knowledge about placement and allocation, and the ability to take objects then that would be comprised of methods and data of varying sizes and expose those up to the file system and allow the file system to manage a flat namespace that would be consistent across a variety of different object-oriented storage devices. So very simply, the object-oriented storage devices manage the allocation and placement of the data associated with the objects, they expose methods to access those, and then they pass that up to the file system. This would provide native support for disk, flash, PCM, and archival storage, and you could even expose new capabilities through a publish-subscribe type interface. But the important thing here is we're presenting a flat address space. And the object, basically the file system, only has to manage the objects. It doesn't have to manage the blocks or anything else. And the capabilities that might be exposed and the things we'd be able to do is we'd start by unburdening the file system from having to do the allocation placement and the translation. The object-oriented storage device knows how to do this. And in fact, today, disk drives are inconsistent in the number of sectors they have per track. That's something that's laid down during the manufacturing process. So there's no assumption that can be made about the physical allocation of the physical structure or geometry of the drive. And in this case, we can provide something, a simple method such as find, that would tell you whether or not an object existed on a particular disk or a particular storage device. The existing interfaces would basically become transport mechanisms for object communications. For legacy support, we could even use logical block address numbers, and we could consider them to be objects, and we could continue to virtualize those if we needed to. And so finally, a little bit of our future in this, the unified object-oriented storage architecture is actually an evolution of storage. It supports legacy devices, including those that are virtualized. It has embedded support for new storage and memory devices, and utilizes existing interfaces. So I hope if you're interested in this, you stop by and chat with me at the poster session that will follow this evening. We'll be having a poster there alongside a couple of other good posters about shingled disk. Thank you very much. Hey, I have a question.
Google. So you say it's a work in progress session. So what are the next plans? Do you have something that works? Are you planning to have something that works?
We are. We're actually looking at applying the object-oriented storage device to the shingled disk first, and we're building a shingled disk emulator. That's something Rec is working on. You'll see her talk in a little bit. But we're looking at actually coming up with an object-oriented model, beginning for shingled disk, and then seeing if we can extend that to other storage devices, such as PCM, flash, solid-state disks.
Okay. Another thing is that for a lot of these things, the way they pan out depends a lot on non-technical reasons, like vendors will probably not want to get into writing file system kind of functionality, and the file system people will not want to, stop having visibility into this stuff. So those are kind of things that I think somebody needs to define.
I completely agree. There's a lot of political stuff.
Yes, we'll discuss that later in the hallway. Thank you very much.
Cool.
Baton handoff.
Baton handoff. So is mine.
How do we get this?
There you go.
Right there. Where's the play? All right, so I'll get started right off here. I'm Ian Adams, and this is some work I'm doing with my advisor, Ethan Meller, and we're looking at challenges in long-term logging and tracing. So starting off, why do we even need to care about multi-year tracing? We're great at doing, you know, capturing things. What's the problem here? Well, the first thing is, why do we even need this in the first place, is some behaviors aren't actually apparent in the short term. We've run into several cases already where if we will have multi-year data sets for archival storage systems, or if we just look at even a few months at a time, we draw radically different conclusions from if we look at the entire three-year data set. In one case, we found that if we looked at any individual couple months, we found very sparse read activity, but if we looked at the whole 3 years, it turned out that actually 100% of the archive was read multiple times over that three-year data set. So what's the problem in getting this data? We're pretty good at capturing it. We have things like snapshots, we can mirror network ports, we can instrument the systems, we have call interceptors. That's not the problem. The problem is actually maintaining this data after we've captured it. There's enormous amounts of data. When you're dealing with multi-year time spans, you're inevitably going to have things like logger hiccups, you're going to have activities that are dropped for no apparent reason, and so forth. So what we do is we use our experience in long-term log analysis, as we looked at several multi-year data sets at this point, to identify some challenges and some initial approaches to addressing these problems, and we're planning on integrating these into an overall logging framework. So one of the first challenges we found was the trace resolution. Oftentimes, these traces and logs are just very large coalescence of short-term logs. And some of this might be very, very fine and difficult to work with when you're talking about years worth of data, but there's still useful things in there. On top of all of that, you know, some people will suggest, we'll just keep it anyway, storage is cheap, but that's not always the problem. Sometimes it's just really unwieldy to work with, and it comes down to we don't all have Google's resources to work with. So our initial solution is to periodically transform older log data to new resolutions. For example, we might have something like, say, a timestamp down at millisecond granularity. 2 years down the road, you might not need that. You just care that a file was accessed, not down to the millisecond when it was accessed. On top of this, we can leave interesting events at the original resolution. There's a lot of work we can leverage in automated anomaly detection where we can say something odd happened here, so let's leave that as is. Next thing we're talking about here is noting absence. One of the things we frequently run into in these multi-year traces is we'll see sudden reductions in activity, not just for a little bit, but sometimes for a day or two. And we can't answer the question, is that actually a reduction in activity, or is the system down? Is a node down? Is a process down? Is it a maintenance cycle? We don't know. So what we're proposing is making sure that we explicitly note when a process or node is down within the logs themselves. Next is system state. We found that having an incomplete view of the system state can really limit the analysis. So if you just have snapshots, you can't tell what happened in between the two. You might be able to tell a file was written, though you can't tell how many times or what was actually written to. Correspondingly, if you just have a trace, you can't answer questions like, what does the namespace look like? So our proposal is to periodically take snapshots of system state along with this logging and tracing. We can use this in combination to answer additional questions like things about the namespace. And a really neat one we can do is we can use it to check trace coverage. We can take one snapshot, then use the trace as a delta on top of that, create another sort of snapshot, and compare it to the real system one we took, and get an idea of what the trace is capturing and missing. Finally, the last one we're looking at as format shifts. And this turns out to be kind of a surprising one, but it turns out when you have people that are maintaining these and growing these logs over years, occasionally they will do things like decide that this format's better, but they won't note that in the log, so we'll have situations where our parser will suddenly break for no reason halfway through. And breaking a parser is actually sort of the better outcome. Worse, it can silently corrupt results. We'll find situations where the parser managed to chug on through, but now we're just having garbage in there and we weren't even aware of it. So our proposed solution for this is to periodically check for format consistency, make sure that everything's looking like prior entries. If not, note that in the logs themselves. So to draw it all together, we're looking at challenges in long-term tracing. The things we talked about today were trace resolution, noting process or node absence, capturing the total system state, and looking at format consistency. And we plan on pulling these all together into a logging framework. And if there's any questions.
So you mentioned that in multi-year traces you will have periods their workload is different, right? But on the other hand, there are also periods their workload is the same, right? So you not only can note the absence of a node, but you can also notice that, you know, during the first and second day, the workload is pretty much the same. So can we actually store only the part of a trace for the first day and say that for the second day it was the same?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you are thinking about doing something
like that? Yeah, we're looking at all sorts of different compression methods, things like that, but very early work at this point. Cool. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm going to talk about dynamic block management for cloud computing system. My name is Dulcar Arteaga. I'm working in this project with my colleague Douglas Ozot and my advisor, Dr. Min Chao, all of us for Florida International University. So as an introduction, cloud computing system and virtualized environment commonly use network storage system in order to provide data storage for virtual machines. As an example, we can have iSCSI and NVD and SAN. So virtual machines, usually in these kind of environments, store the virtual disks and images through the network in this kind of network storage. This gives us a lot of advantages, like in order to move one virtual machine from one host to a different host, the time for doing this live migration is very short, and also increase the data availability. But in this kind of environments, we have a problem when the number of virtual machines and number of hosts that are sharing this network storage increase in a considerable number. So the network storage becomes the bottleneck, and the performance is affected in the virtual machines. So even though we can appreciate that the performance on virtual machine are affected by the workloads that all virtual machines running in different hosts are running. So our goal for this project is to improve the I/O performance inside the virtual machine by providing caching in the client side. So our proposed solution is dynamic block level client caching for cloud computing system and virtualized environment. So which help us to exploit the data locality in the host. So virtual machine can access to the data more faster and don't need to go through the network for all the time. And for this, we use a capacity and a storage of the emerging devices like SSDs, that which provide a higher throughput. And we plug these kind of devices in the host so we can exploit the higher throughput that these devices provide. And we implement this our prototype in the block level layer, so we can support different kind of cloud storage systems. And also we support flexible dynamic configuration of the cache replacement policies and different kinds of write policies. So this is a big picture of our architecture that already we have a current prototype that is working. So this picture is more or less similar to the previous one, so, but here we can see that we have already plugged the cache device inside every single host. So all the virtual machines that are running in this single host are sharing this cache device and can take advantage of this data locality. But in order to do this, we create a mapping. So per virtual machine, we create a virtual cache device, and then we map this virtual cache device to the original images of these virtual machines, and that goes through the cache. For our evaluation, we use SSD as a cache devices, and I will show you now what we have for our results. So in our university, we have a cluster, so where we run these kind of experiments. For this experiment, we use a cluster nodes that every single host can host up to 12 virtual machines. All of them, every single host use one SSD as a cache device, so we have eight SSDs as a cache, and all of these eight nodes are sharing the network storage and they're using iSCSI. So we can see in the experiments, like we are running, we are booting from 12 virtual machines to 96 virtual machines concurrently. And we can see like the blue line here is the normal response time for booting without using the cache. And the green line is the one that we get when the cache is warm. So we are still we have still room for improvement when the cache is cold. And we also run IOZone benchmark in 7 and 14 virtual machines concurrently, and we got the throughput of this. And we can see in the or a figure that when we are using the cache, the throughput is very high. And we are still working on this, and we are planning to do more improvements in our prototype. So thank you very much. I will take any question. And also, we are presenting our poster, so everybody is invited to have a chat with us.
Quick question, actually two questions. You are buffering writes. What do you do if the VM moves around?
Right
cache coherence story?
We are having two policies for writing. We have write through and write back. So for write through, we only redirect the write and invalidate the cache. And for write back, we keep it for a little while. Like we are working on a log level, so then we flash the cache.
Regarding your read cache, do you take into account the fact that there is huge overlap between the blocks of different VMs, especially when those VMs are booting and there have hundreds of Windows VMs?
Yeah, we are doing the mapping per virtual machine, so every block that comes, we differentiate from one virtual machine to another one, so we map to different blocks if it's a different virtual machine.
So,
very nice.
I will follow up.
Now I will present our ongoing research work, case exploring content redundancy for improving space efficiency and benchmarking accuracy in storage emulation. Storage emulator is a very useful tool for storage benchmarking. Manulator is the pioneer work to promote timing accurate storage emulation. That way is the state-of-the-art storage emulator that saves space by omitting the file data but storing file metadata only. Our case is meant to support content return and space-efficient storage emulation. Why is the capability of returning data content so important in storage emulation? Let's look at the motivation study. First, we compress 3-bitmap image with the same resolution and the same file size. Then we use block trace to trace I/O during saving compressed files. From this figure, we can see the I/O pattern significantly differentiated from each other. As the first speaker said, storage performance depends on the data content. So it indicates without storing exact data content, it's prone to either overestimating or underestimating the real performance of a storage device or system. Our proposed solution is CASE, a flexible, content-aware, and space-efficient storage emulator for benchmarking. The basic idea is simple. We deploy data deduplication in storage emulation. CASE has three goals. The first one is the time accuracy. We need to guarantee the accuracy of benchmark results. The second goal is space efficiency. We achieve this goal by redundancy elimination. The third goal is flexibility. We want our storage emulator to have no modification to any file system, database, and blocker interface. This page shows the architectural view of our case. Our case is beneath the general SCSI target subsystem. From the user's perspective, our case storage emulator looks like a SCSI disk. Case includes three modules: request handler, timing service, and storage service. Request handler is used to receive error requests from the upper layer. That's a SCSI command, and forward error request to the other two modules. Timing service is to compute the response time for every incoming I/O. Storage service includes three parts. Fingerprint store is a RAM resident index facility to provide capability of fingerprint generation, lookup, and update. Meta table is used to manage the mapping information between LBA and the PBA. Data store is used to store and retrieve data chunks onto the backend storage. We can use SSD and RAM at the backend storage. For the implementation part, we deploy fixed size chunking for simplicity, and we use a user space and a pure block level implementation for flexibility. This page shows some preliminary results. The trace-driven evaluation results are shown in this table. We feed three traces onto our storage emulator. From this table, we can see case can save space by two orders of magnitude. This page shows the result of a real-world workload-based evaluation. We copy both virtual machine image onto the same storage emulator. Okay. Cache saves space by up to 33%. Okay. Sorry for the figure. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
I'm Anya Valik from the Max Planck Institute for Software Systems, and I'll talk about trusted storage today. Trusted storage uses trusted primitives at the storage device layer to ensure data integrity and confidentiality independently of higher software layers. Today's storage systems are increasingly complex. They consist of many software layers with millions of lines of code, including a database, the OS, the file system, drivers, and so on. Network storage systems introduce even more layers, increasing the complexity further. Emerging third-party storage services add additional complexity because the client cannot even verify what safeguards the provider uses to protect your data. This complexity makes the system vulnerable to bugs, viruses, and operator errors, which in turn threaten the data integrity, durability, and confidentiality. We address this problem with a trusted storage architecture that uses trusted primitives at the storage device layer. A trusted storage device enforces user-provided policies associated with application objects, like files. These policies grant read or write permissions based on, for example, the requester's identity, a hardware or software configuration, or time. Moreover, trusted storage devices make signed statements about the stored objects, including a fully qualifying name, the associated policy, and the content hash. By this, we ensure integrity, confidentiality, and accountability independent of higher software layers. Let us now look at two examples showcasing the power of trusted storage. In the first example, let's consider a software bug or a virus or an operator threatening to corrupt online backup data. With trusted storage, we choose a policy for a backup snapshot that allows no writes prior to specified date which corresponds to the snapshot's expected lifetime. For instance, in an incremental backup system, daily backups would be kept for a week, weekly backups would be kept for a month, and so on. With this policy in place, no software layer outside the trusted storage can actually tamper with the data. In the second example, a virus threatens to replace an executable file with a Trojan. Again, with a trusted storage device, we can choose a policy for executable files where writes are allowed only if the new data is signed by a vendor and the current version number is at least the current minus one, limiting rollback attacks. This basically makes it impossible for viruses to replace existing executables with a Trojan. And these were just two simple examples showcasing types of policies trusted storage can support. In general, trusted storage can control the integrity and confidentiality based on the identity, again, and the hardware software configuration and time as well as geolocation. Moreover, we can use the certificates to verify how many replicas or the location of these replicas within a third-party storage. In summary, trusted storage provides a storage-level accountability and enforcement of application objects, and all these guarantees are independent of any higher software layers. We're currently in the process of implementing a trusted storage device with a small amount of NAND flash, about 0.05 of the disk capacity. We expect our implementation to be in the range of less than 3% overhead. Thank you very much. Please come to see our poster tonight, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad to give you a presentation of working in progress research accelerated duplication by exploiting pipeline and parallelism with multi-core and many-core processors. This work is from the Huazhong University of Science and Technology, China, and the University of the Liberal Arts Gar Lincoln. Data deduplication has gained increasing attention for its spatial efficient functionality, not only save the storage space, but also minimize the transmission of the redundant data in storage systems. Since the computer power of single core stagnates and while the throughput of storage devices continue to increase, the chunking and fingerprinting stage of deduplication is becoming much slower than the writing stage in real-world data deduplications. These figures show the throughput of chunking, fingerprinting, and writing stage in our data deduplication system. It suggests that content-defined chunking and fixed-size chunking-based deduplication throughput drops to 100 and 200 megabytes per second due to the time-consuming chunking and fingerprinting. Those how to utilize the increasing computer power with multi-core in the data deduplication system is become urgent. Then we try to analyze how to minimize the deduplication and computer overheads with our approaches, given ton of chunking, fingerprinting, writing, deduplication fact, and the parallel throughs. The serial deduplication can be computed as the total ton of chunking, fingerprinting, and writing. The pipeline deduplication can be computed as max time of the chunking, fingerprinting, and writing. Partner deduplication can be computed as the max time of parallel chunking and parallel fingerprinting and writing. Actually, data deduplication can speed up the traditional write performance if there is enough duplicated data. But the complicated parallelization of deduplication is not very easy in the real-world deduplication system. One of the challenges comes from the content-defined chunking. The content-defined chunking are designed to address the issue of the file modification among the different file versions. It uses a sliding window move on the file contents. Those it is content-dependent, not easy to fully parallelized. That's why we propose the PyDedupe system. It used to fully exploit the parallelizing data duplication systems. It designed a deduplication pipeline to feed the deduplication processes such as data unions and the chunking unions and the function units such as chunking fingerprinting and indexing and writing chunk data and metadata. Also, PyDedupe designed a deduplication parallelizer to further parallelize the fingerprinting and chunking. It divided the data stream to several data sections and parallel the chunking of the each data section to the on the different core. After that, we need rechunk the boundary of the data sections. We can choose to not do the boundary rechunking. This is considered our ongoing worker. The preliminary results show. By exploring pipeline and parallel of data deduplication, PyDedupe can accelerate the deduplication with a factor of 4, both of the fixed size chunking and the content defined chunking approaches. In addition, PyDedupe is able to achieve the 250% of and 120% of the traditional rate performance with the fixed size chunking and the content defined chunking approaches, respectively, if there is enough duplicated data. PyDedupe is an ongoing worker research project. There's a lot of problems that remains to improve the performance of PyDedupe to boost the performance with the increasing number of cores as follows. That's all. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jun Suzuki. I'm a research staff member of NEC Corporation Japan. Our presentation today is on high-throughput direct data transfer between PCI Express solid-state drives. PCI Express over Ethernet is a technology that provides scalable connections of IO devices using an Ethernet to a host server. Regarding data processing using these IO devices, there are many kinds of data transfer between IO devices without any data processing by a host server. One example is data reallocation in a storage system, data are transferred from a disk to another disk. Another example is writing data to a network attached to the storage, data are transferred from a NIC to a disk, like this. However, in current system, all transferred data between IO devices must be sent to the main memory of a host server. As a result, congestions of congestions of data flows between IO devices on the server link becomes a bottleneck in data transfer. So our motivation in this presentation is, why not transfer data directly between IO devices like this? And this is our proposal, and it is called Direct Connect. We use a standard Ethernet to connect a host server and multiple IO devices. PCI Express to Ethernet bridge is used to connect the host server and multiple IO device to a standard Ethernet. The point we solve is that current IO devices cannot transfer data or communicate directly with each other. So we use a direct connect buffer located in an IO side PCI Express to Ethernet bridge, and using this buffer to relay DMA of IO devices. The mechanism work like this. First, user-level program triggers data transfer between IO devices. Then, a DC operator, which is the device driver, makes a source device write data to the DC buffer using its device driver. Then, the DC operator makes a destination device read data from the DC buffer. In this way, IO devices are controlled by a host server, while data are directly transferred between IO devices using an Ethernet. This is our experimental results. We implemented our method to direct data transfer between PCI Express SSDs. We measured the bandwidth of the data transfer between the IO devices in two cases. One is using the conventional method. In this method, the data will transfer to the main memory of the host server. In the second case, we use our proposal. We also set the lane number of PCI Express of the server side PCI Express to Ethernet bridge to by 8 or by 1. And in the by 1 case, the bandwidth became the bottleneck for the data transfer between IO devices. As we can see from the result, in the by 1 case, our proposed method increased the bandwidth by 86%, and it enabled the data transfer at the maximum performance of SSD. In the future, we will develop direct data transfer between the NIC and the SSD, and we also investigate the method to process storage metadata when the addressing data are directly transferred between IO devices. Thank you for your time.
I think this is working. All right. All right, well, good afternoon. My name is Abni Baldani. I'm down here because I bear an uncanny resemblance to an inanimate wooden object, and so I'm hiding from James. And I'm here to talk to you about grouping data to improve scalability, or availability, sorry. And this is the art of failing silently, but don't be afraid. It's not as bad as you think it is, and I'll explain what that means in a moment. So, we're all familiar with the flood of data that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. And we're changing how we think about this data. So where it used to be we'd print something off to file it away, now we actually scan something in to file it away. So we expect data to be around for a very long time. As a result, we have these big systems that we need to erasure code for reliability, and big low-cost systems tend to have large stripes of code. So rebuild is both inevitable and slow. The average lifetime of a disk is something like 5 years, like a Silicon Valley engineer. 5 years, they're done, they're out of there. And so we need to learn how to handle rebuilds. Now, this is a kind of old graph. It's from an IBM DS5000. And we can see that as the RAID gets more complex, the elapsed time for rebuild increases. And this is 25 drives down here. In case you can't see that, this is 6 hours. Now, these are 300 gigabyte disks. Nowadays, disks are around 3 terabytes. So this 1.5 down here is all of a sudden a 15. And we can see that rebuild is just getting insurmountably bad, assuming just full disk failure and normal rebuild. So in a nutshell, our goal is to reduce rebuild time by figuring out access groups of data, grouping them together on disk, and then striping intelligently so that when disks fail, you don't take out every access group. You take out as few access groups as possible. So when I say group data, what do I mean? We use whatever data that we can get, so trace data, block I/O, or metadata, to create access groups. We can always at least get block I/O data, because you can get that just by sticking a hardware analyzer on a bus and just collecting data as it comes in. If we have metadata, we can use component analysis to get even better groupings. Then, once we have the features and the distance, we can group whatever is adjacent in our feature space. And in this work in particular, what we're doing is we're creating graphs based on these distance metrics, and we're doing clique cover on these graphs to get tight groups. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. The cylinders here are disks. The squares correspond to reliability groups. And the little shapes or colors, depending on how far back you are in the room, are access groups. You can sort of think of access groups as an abstraction of users or projects or applications. Basically, things that if they lose a little bit of data, you don't know what it is, you're not getting any work done. So here, things are striped pretty much evenly, as we are prone to do, unaware of the data. And when this one disk goes down, everybody's stuck. Nobody's getting any work done because it affects every group. Instead here, if we can actually lay out data according to the access group, then we can make it so that only Mr. Lightning Man's stuck. Now, he may take a little bit longer to rebuild because the disk bandwidth obviously is the one disk that he's rebuilding from, but we don't care because it's only one guy. And for the rest of these guys, it's a silent failure. And that's why we call it the art of failing silently, because if your data isn't affected, you don't care what's failing. So we think it's a pretty good trade-off if one guy loses 10 blocks instead of 10 guys losing one block. Our status right now is that we're using Python to simulate fault injection, actually. So we're really looking forward to Yapi's work. And we're injecting that into real-world traces, because we don't have real failure traces. We're modeling correlated failures, because we're interested in, obviously, rack level or whatnot. The questions that we're curious right now about are, what does changing scrubbing frequency do? And what will this be fast enough?
Okay, so we're all set. All right, so what I'm going to be talking about today, first of all, I should mention that normally you wouldn't have an advisor give a talk like this. The reason I'm giving this talk is that Daniel sent an email yesterday saying, I have 101 degree fever, and of course we told him, please don't get everybody in the room sick, go ahead, stay home, get better. So hopefully Daniel will feel better very soon. So what I'm going to be talking about is building an economic model for long-term storage. And this is joint work between our group and also Ara Zadok, David Rosenthal. It's kind of confusing when you have a David Rosenthal and a Daniel Rosenthal in the group trying to read emails. Gets a little bit confusing. So the motivation for this is pretty simple. We've got data that we want to store for a really long time. We've got photos. We've got medical records. Problem is that you don't want to be writing a check every single year for your medical records. You decide you don't have enough money one year, all of a sudden now all your medical records are gone. What you want to do instead is say, look, you know, when I had that x-ray done at the hospital, it cost a lot of money. Take the money I spent and tack on $10 or $20, whatever you think is right, and that's enough to store the data forever, or at least as long as I'm alive anyway. This is great, except we don't know how much money that is. We'd like to know how much money it is, but we don't because there are two things we're not sure about. The first one is future events that are predictable, like we've got to replace our storage. Disks don't last forever. We're going to have to replace them a bunch of times during my lifetime. Of course, we're going to change from disks to flash to protein memories to whatever. We can't predict it that well, but at least we can try. Now, other events are going to be more random, and we're not going to be able to predict those at all. Things like the floods in Thailand that made your disks a lot more expensive. We'll see that actually has an impact on how likely your data is to survive. And so what we're doing to approach this is Monte Carlo modeling. This was done originally, it's been around for a long time, but there's some people who did this for financial planning. Instead of saying, well, we think you're going to make 7% a year, they run lots and lots of simulations over time and say, well, if you do this, here's the likelihood you'll reach age 90 and still have money left. And you can decide, is 95% likely to have money, or is 90% likely, or 80%? You can pick the likelihood of having money left. So what we're doing is simulating a storage system, simulating hypothetical futures, and repeating this stuff, drawing conclusions from the results. So I'll go through a couple of examples of policy decisions we can make. The first one is hard drive service lifetime. In other words, you've got a disk-based archive for long-term storage, and we're assuming, for now anyway, Kreider's Law. Disk storage gets about half as cheap over every year. We know it won't go on forever, but we've got to start somewhere. We also assume that hard drives might last anywhere from 0 to 10 years. What do we find out? Well, you'd think you put those hard drives in there, you leave them there forever because that's cheaper, right? Wrong. You want to replace it after about 2.5 years, even if they could last 10 years. Now, what does this mean? Well, it means for the hard drive industry building archival disks, if you keep making them smaller, don't spend a lot of money on making them more reliable. Don't care. So the next thing we looked at is density growth rate. In other words, how fast does data grow over time? If the growth rate is kind of slow on the left there, 5, 10% a year, we need 14 times what it costs to buy 1 terabyte to store a terabyte for a really long time. If the growth rate goes to 40% a year, we still need about 5 times as much. So you can see it makes a difference, but the difference is starting to level off on the right there. The next thing we want to look at is not just predictions of rates over time, but what happens when you have one-time events, in this case, the floods in Thailand. I think people might know disk drives got a lot more expensive. You can see in the middle that there's actually a little spike there on the graph showing that when that flood happens at 4 years out, because that's when you're replacing your devices, all of a sudden you get a lot less likely to survive for a long time, or you need more money. Either way, that's a big impact. And we want to try and understand the relationship between a lot of these factors, not be able just to predict stuff, but what things affect the likelihood of survival, your data surviving for a long period of time. So at the moment, we're just generating lots and lots of data. What we want to be able to study, as I said, is trade-offs between how much money you put in up front, how likely you want to have your data in 100 years, and also, should we trade it off by having less erasure coding, more erasure coding? What happens if bad things happen? And what we're doing now is just generating lots and lots of simulation runs and trying to study these trade-offs. If you're interested in this stuff, I encourage you to stop by our poster. David Rosenthal will be the one standing there for much of the time. I'll try to be there a little bit as well. With that, I'm happy to take questions.
Hi, I'm Veka Pichmani from UC Santa Cruz, and I'm going to be talking about a work in progress emulating a shingled write disk. What's a shingled write disk? It's a hard disk drive with shingled tracks, that is, tracks overlapping in such a way that This results in narrower tracks for reading. But the write heads are still wider. So the writes overwrites K such read tracks. So why do we care about this? It promises more than double the capacity of the hard disk drives. And the next generation hard disks are expected to adapt them. But as you can see, random writes may destroy data, and in-place updates become destructible now. So this poses some unique challenges and some interesting research problems to work on. But the hardware is still in production, and we don't have one yet to work with. So we can make it look like we do. The first option we looked at is to simulate one using by extending disk sim. But it was not very suitable for our purposes because we wanted to verify and validate the solutions that were developed for a single write disk. And disk sim models only the performance-related aspects of the disk and does not actually read and write the data. And they also use older disk models. So the solution we finalized on was to emulate the operations on a real hard disk drive. This way, we can also measure near-to-accurate performance results and read and write actual data. Let's see with a simplified example how we achieve this. Here, let's say there were three tracks, 1, 2, and 3 here, and our mapper maintains an index table that points to all three tracks. When, say, K is 2 here, that means that a write to track 1 has to overwrite track 2 also. So what we basically do is, when there's a write to track 1, we update the index and make 2 point to 1, and the write the data only to 1. So here, track 2 is actually read invalidated. So when there is a read to track 2, we first check the index table, and since it points to 1, we redirect the read to 1. This is how we emulate the wider writes and the narrow reads. So we talked about the generic design, but now let's see where this goes in the system stack. We implemented a pseudo device driver, and it creates a single block device in between the application and file system and the regular block device. And here, in our implementation, the mapping is actually at the sector level and not at track level as we saw earlier. So for that, to determine the logical block address of the sector that will be affected by a write, we need to be aware of the physical the disk's physical geometry. So for that, we used a utility called dig, and we got the physical geometry, and we used that. Now, you can also easily add new functionalities to the system, like, for example, report the physical geometry to an upper-level layer. Or you can create banded devices and ask the device to report that in form of new IOCTLs. To summarize, our emulator will fill the gap till a single disk drive is available. But it will be useful even afterwards. But let's say, for example, by means of reporting the physical geometry. Or you can think that I can do a much better job at this if only the disk gives me this value. Then you can modify the driver and make it look like the disk gives you that value. So the current status is we are evaluating our driver, and we plan to make it available to other researchers as well. And as you might have guessed from Andy's talk, we believe in hiding the details behind an object interface. And we plan to work on the object management system for the single write disk and demonstrate the effectiveness using the emulated single disk. That's it. Questions? The last person? So anybody can ask questions now.
So All right, guys, so it looks like we've finished the work in progress session a little bit early. I'd like to thank the presenters for that, as well as what I think are my own undeniable leadership skills in making that dream become reality. I am, of course, available to come to your institution, whether it be a university, whether it be an industrial lab, and come and just talk about the things I've learned in life, such as threatening people with comical acts of violence during academic conferences.